Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us at the Global Taiwan Institute. It is a unique and special day, and one a special occasion for our public seminar series at the Global Taiwan Institute. Now, GTI is the only think tank in Washington, D.C. dedicated exclusively to Taiwan policy research. And we are very pleased to be organizing today's event, a very timely one, on strategic ambiguity under the new U.S. President. Before I begin, I'd like to acknowledge a few esteemed attendees in our room today. They include Dr. David Tsai, Dr. Chen, who are our members of our advisory committee, to include Tom Hughes, who's a member of our advisory board. And I'll also acknowledge General Gregson for coming to attend our event today, and thank you very much. And I think it stands as a testament of the appeal of the work that we are doing here to provide greater analysis about Taiwan-related issues in Washington. So, The world watched this morning as the United States elected its 45th president. President-elect Trump's vision for the United States' role in global affairs and relations with Asia, especially with its allies and partners, will take shape in the months to come. The United States' policy towards Taiwan will not be an exception. As President-elect Trump considers U.S. priorities with regards to its Asia policy, in particular Taiwan, today's seminar will look at a key pillar in the U.S. approach to the Taiwan Strait at this pivotal time in U.S., Asian, and global history, and that is the policy of strategic ambiguity. Strategic ambiguity is a policy based on the idea of deliberately preserving uncertainty about what the United States would do if war broke out between China and Taiwan. It could also be described as a strategy of dual deterrence. Moreover, it's not necessarily a Republican or Democratic policy. It was followed by the Carter, Reagan, Bush 41, Clinton, Bush 43, and Obama administrations. The parameters of its application have expanded and contracted over time, depending on the situation. But the environment has changed so much now that some have called into question whether the policy has outlived its utility. Now, we are very pleased to have assembled a phenomenal group of discussants to help us understand the context of the policy's origins, its application to a very new situation, and most importantly, its utility under a Trump presidency. So to my immediate left, I have Joe Bosco. Joe has served as both Director of the Asia-Pacific Disaster Relief and Humanitarian Affairs and China Desk Officer for the Office of the Secretary of Defense. He is a member of the U.S.-China Task Force at the Center for the National Interest and a non-resident senior associate at CSIS. To his immediate left, we have Chris Griffin, who has been the Executive Director of the Foreign Policy Initiative since January 2013. Previously, he served as Legislative Director to Senator Joe Lieberman, advising the Senator on the full range of legislative proposals and key votes. He was also previously with the American Enterprise Institute. I will also note that Chris Griffin is one of our advisory board members as well. And last but not least, we have Bridge Colby. Bridge is the save the best for last. Robert Gates Senior Fellow at the Center for New American Security, where he focuses on issues relating to defense strategy, U.S. alliances, intelligence, and related issues. In 2012, he served as the Deputy Head for National Security Personnel on the Mitt Romney pre-transition effort and Senior Campaign Advisor. So in keeping with the format of our seminar series, where we like to keep this more of a conversation, I prepared several questions that I'll ask the panelists, And I also invite the panelists, even for a question not directed specifically to you, if you have a comment that you'd like to add, please do. Joe, I'd like to start with you. Joe, strategic ambiguity has become somewhat of a cliche, a word used frequently, and like most frequently used words, its meaning and use have evolved over time. I think to really understand this policy, we really need to go back to how it began. So can you describe the context that brought about this policy?
Thank you, Russell, for, for organizing this program and for your impeccable timing. One night after we all spent 12 hours or so watching television instead of sleeping. But your timing is also significant in another way. That is that in less than a month, we'll be observing the anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. On December 7th, 1941, Japan also attacked the Philippines, not from carriers at sea, but from the island of Formosa, which General Douglas MacArthur later called the unsinkable aircraft carrier. The U.S. recognized the strategic significance of that island and, in fact, bombed it several times during the war. When Japan surrendered and peace came to the Pacific, the U.S. attention shifted elsewhere to the point where in January 1950, General MacArthur and Secretary of State Dean Acheson laid out U.S. strategic imperatives in Asia. And the map they drew excluded Formosa and South Korea. Kim Il-sung, Mao Zedong, and Joseph Stalin saw a green light, and Kim beat Mao to the punch and invaded South Korea. The U.S. and the United Nations responded, and the Korean War was on. Henry Kissinger said, "We didn't expect the invasion. China didn't expect our response." President Truman sent the Seventh Fleet back into the Taiwan Strait. After the war, President Eisenhower, that was, by the way, I think the first example of strategic ambiguity when Acheson and MacArthur made those speeches excluding Taiwan and South Korea from our defense perimeter. After the war, President Eisenhower, to avoid any ambiguity in the future, executed mutual defense treaties with the Republic of China on Taiwan and the Republic of Korea. And the Seventh Fleet stayed in the Taiwan Strait and in the region for the next decade or so, longer than that, actually, until 1971. 71 was Nixon's opening to China. And the first thing he did before he went to meet with the Chinese leaders was to show his good faith by withdrawing the Seventh Fleet from the Taiwan Strait. And we had the Shanghai Communique, in which the U.S. acknowledged the Chinese position that, quote, all Chinese on both sides of the Taiwan Strait believe there's one China and Taiwan is not part of it. And the U.S. expressed its interest in a peaceful resolution of the status of Taiwan, but it did not explicitly commit to the defense of Taiwan. So there you have the beginnings, again, of ambiguity as to what the U.S. would do about Taiwan.
I think that's actually a good follow-on, and I think you maybe you're just about to address this issue, and that is that, you know, the late Dr. Nancy Tucker, who was the first Assistant Deputy Director of National Intelligence for Analytic Integrity and Standards, wrote in her famous book, Dangerous Straits, published in 2005, that the parameters of strategic ambiguity expanded and contracted on various occasions. You outlined the origins under the Truman and Eisenhower administration. Can you explain for us what you meant by that, and can you give us examples of when such occasions have occurred?
Well, I wouldn't want to try to put myself in the mind of the great and late Nancy Tucker, but the way I understand it is that our perception of the threat region evolved over time, and we adopted our stated policy to meet those perceived threats. For example, by 1995, the 7th Fleet having been eliminated or withdrawn from the Taiwan Strait all that time, we had the missile crisis where China fired toward the Taiwan Strait, which has to be done ways to Cornell. The U.S., President Clinton, sent an aircraft carrier battle group, through the Taiwan Strait. First time it had been back in the Strait since Nixon withdrew it, 5 years earlier. China protested furiously, and the U.S. explanation was it was a weather diversion. It did not state we were doing it to preserve stability in the region. China was interested in that response and decided to pursue it further. They met later that year with Assistant Secretary Joseph Nye and asked him specifically, what would the United States do if China attacked Taiwan? Blunt, direct question. They didn't get a blunt, direct answer. Secretary Nye said, we don't know, and you don't know. It would depend on the circumstances. There is the declared statement of strategic ambiguity. We might do something, we might not do something. Now, what effect would that have on the Chinese strategists and war planners? The United States has just told them that there are some circumstances under which we will not defend Taiwan. I'm a Chinese war planner. I want to know what those circumstances are, and if there's anything I can do to help create them. That was the beginning of the massive Chinese buildup of an anti-access and area denial weaponry, including attack submarines and anti-ship missiles. So that policy continued to the present day, really. And China does not yet know how the United States would respond to an attack on Taiwan. And there are those who believe the United States does not know how it would attack, how it would respond to such an attack. In 2000, two things happened, two elections in Taiwan and in the United States. Chen Shui-bian of the DPP was elected in Taiwan with a strong pro-independence platform. George W. Bush was elected in the United States, and one of the first questions he received after taking his oath was, what will the United States do if China attacks Taiwan? Same question that Nye answered in 1995. His answer was, whatever it takes, which was a pretty clear statement that the United States was committed to the defense of Taiwan. Well, as probably most of you know, that response created a furor in the China community and the think tank community in the United States and even among the people in the Bush administration, and it was very quickly walked back. So we're back to strategic ambiguity.
I think that's actually a good segue, and I think we can go back to your views on the role of strategic ambiguity in promoting peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait. I wanted to go to you, Bridge, because you and Walter Slocum, the former Under Secretary of Defense for Policy, wrote a fantastic piece, I must say, in the Wall Street Journal back in May, entitled U.S. Ambiguity on Taiwan is Dangerous. Can you walk us through your key arguments in that article, and why did you think that the policy is now dangerous?
Sure. It's basically really a strategic argument, and I think it comes from the perception or the judgment on the part of Walt and myself, and I think he signed on to the article as well, I think, without reservation, so I think I can at least characterize his position in this respect. Strategic ambiguity can work very well under certain kinds of conditions. In particular, conditions in which one side has a very, very substantial military advantage over the practical contingency, over the practical military conflict. And I think that was the case in with respect to Taiwan and People's Republic for many, many years. I mean, the People's Republic obviously had a very large standing army, but its ability to project power across the Taiwan Strait is essentially nugatory. It was essentially minimal in the face of an American effort to block it. And in fact, the United States could block any such attempt to, certainly to invade Taiwan or even to impose a blockade at a relatively limited cost and a relatively limited degree of escalation. If you look at the RAND, big RAND scorecard report on the U.S.-China military balance, their assessment in the mid-1990s was the U.S. could basically block any such attempt, I think, with none or minimal level of attacks on the Chinese mainland itself. So, in a sense, the level of resolve from the United States to be able to do the mission was very high. Was very low because the American capability to do so was very, very, very high. So the United States could basically leave ambiguous, could afford to leave ambiguous the degree of commitment because the effort that would be required by the United States was so low. So China would understand that even if the United States was not very resolute in defending Taiwan, the task would be so feasible and at such a relatively low cost that it was likely to, the U.S. was very likely to do it. So the other thing was that this was also kind of, the other reason why the U.S. could think that there was restraint was the sense that the Chinese might think that eventually Taiwan would voluntarily unify or come to some arrangement with the People's Republic and with the mainland. These two fundamental factors are no longer hold, they no longer obtain. First of all, the military situation has become much, much, much more difficult. I mean, Taiwan's Ministry of National Defense itself several years ago assessed that by the early 2020s, the United, even a U.S. intervention would not be able to block a determined PLA assault on the island. Not just potentially a blockade, but an invasion itself. And I think if you look at a lot of very serious analysis by institutions like the RAND Corporation and others, and you hear what senior U.S. defense officials say, there's a real understanding that the military effort would be very, very difficult and also very, very costly. So that changes the fundamental dynamic, which China now, when it looks at the United States, it's going to say, this would be a very difficult effort for them. So that's going to change their assessment of how likely our decision to actually come in and defend Taiwan is. The other thing that's changed is it seems to me pretty clear that the people of Taiwan do not want to change the status quo. I mean, there's a certain amount of the population that's interested in independence, but the majority, or at least a substantial plurality of the population, wants to maintain the status quo. And the number of people who are interested in formal unification with the mainland is under 10%. And even the number of people who identify as Chinese, and certainly exclusively Chinese rather than Taiwanese, is small and shrinking. So basically the Chinese now are in a situation where their ability to take Taiwan or to impose very, very severe costs on the United States in attempting to do so has gone up. And Taiwan does not look like it's going to fall into their lap peacefully. So when I look at this, I think to myself, why do wars happen? Well, you know, wars happen for a lot of reasons, but when you look back, the Korea example that Joe Bosco elucidated is a perfect example, where basically the communist leadership basically made a rational decision based on what the Americans had said, that they could go out and attack South Korea. Now, it turned out that the American people got angry, and if you have a direct assault on a free country, we tend to get angry. And same thing happened in 1990 when Saddam Hussein said, "Oh, I think the Americans just gave me a green light." Some argue that the same thing happened in 1914, particularly with respect to the British, who had an ambiguous commitment to France. So all of these say to me, people send this, "Oh, ambiguities are really wise and clever policy, and it's good for deterrence." No, no, no. The best deterrent is when the other guy knows what's going to happen, and it's going to be much worse than what he can get. Now that, unfortunately, I don't think we can get that level anymore because of the growth of Chinese military power. But ambiguity, now instead of communicating flexibility for a very, very strong and advantageous position, now risks communicating that we are just simply punting the issue and that the Chinese could judge, well, I think the Americans are fundamentally bluffing. And so to me, I say, and I think Walt as well, I think it's very hard for me to envision that the United States would not defend Taiwan if Taiwan was in a sense, what we view them as in the right. And so in a sense, we're going to end up going to war with China anyway if they attack Taiwan, probably. So then we might as well be clear about that to China so they understand, and then make clear what the conditions are to them.
And that leads me to my next question. Yeah. In your article, you stated that in addition to what Washington should do, such as reinforcing U.S. military capability to defend Taiwan, making clear the no-use-of-force policy, Taipei needs to upgrade its own defense and avoid actions that could justifiably be seen as unreasonable. Now, can you give us examples of what you think might be justifiably unreasonable?
Yeah, I think declaring independence would be one of them. I think basically any significant political action, or military action for that matter, that could significantly alienate China, and that has not been taken in consultation with the United States. Now, there may be things that Taiwan should do that should alienate China, but Taiwan should strive to do those things in consultation with the United States and in a way that always gives Taiwan the political position of being the reasonable party. I think that's what our arrangement is with most of our treaty allies, essentially. Like, if South Korea wakes up one day and decides to invade North Korea, I think we reserve the right to say, well, you know, that's not what we signed up for. You know, if Estonia invades Russia, you know, there are things that our ally, an alliance is not carte blanche, right? Now, in the case of Taiwan, because of the difficulty of the challenge, it involves exceptional sensitivity from Taipei. But it's not of a fundamentally different type from what we have with all of our allies. I think the other thing is that Taiwan needs to make real efforts on its own defenses. And I laud South Korea, which has made real efforts to increase its defense spending over the last few years. I think Taipei needs to follow suit and spend money on things that are actually militarily useful in making a Chinese invasion or blockade, but particularly an invasion, very, very difficult. And that means things like anti-ship cruise missiles, smart mines, anti-air systems, cyber defenses, these kinds of things that are, they're not as attractive as F-16s and submarines, but that are more oriented towards really creating time and also making China's job as difficult as humanly possible, which will enable the Americans to engage more productively.
Great. I'd like to shift gear a little bit and turn to you, Chris. And our discussions thus far has focused on the executive branch, focused on what the president could announce in terms of changing the policy of strategic ambiguity to announce something more clarity, perhaps. Now there's clearly another branch of government that also has a key role to play, and that's the legislative branch. And Chris, you've worked on the Hill from 2008 to 2013. Correct me if I got those years wrong, and probably have a better sense of the pulse of on the Hill than at least anyone on this panel for sure. What has the views of the Hill been on the policy of strategic ambiguity? And how would Congress react in the event that the U.S. declared an end?
Great. Russell, thank you likewise for the opportunity to join the conversation. Sitting between Joe and Bridge is a pleasure and an honor and quite intimidating given the depth of knowledge that they have both on the specifics of this relationship and some of the broader issues surrounding it, but happy to have the opportunity to participate. So I really go back to that experience in 2001 as probably being the most specific test case that we've had of what it could look like when the administration offers an utterance that would suggest a change to current policy. And in this context, it's important to emphasize, more so than many foreign relations issues, our relationship with Taiwan is really shaped by the TRA. In a unique way, that a legislative role here that we don't have in many bilateral or international issues. So specific interest. And one of the things that we saw on the Hill in 2001 when that occurred was some modest consternation at the specific process by which it occurred. That President Bush iterated in an interview on Good Morning America, of all places, something similar to what he'd actually said during the debates. And March 2000 Republican debate, he essentially said the Chinese need to understand our one China policy, and that means that we'll defend Taiwan. It's something to that effect, you know, paraphrasing. So this was a position that he'd articulated as a candidate, and hearing him articulate it as the president made it a very different moment. something that may be worth keeping in mind today as we look forward to some of the changes that could be coming down the road as we transition from the election to the next administration. There were really only two members that I saw who spoke up on this at the time, certainly on the congressional record. They're both around today. You probably know them, Senator Biden and a Senator Kerry. So they both took the time to take to the floor. Senator Kerry, I think, actually more in a hearing statement than he then inserted into the record, and both went out of their way to state, as Biden put it, quote, "The United States is not obligated to defend Taiwan and hasn't been since we abrogated the 1954 Mutual Defense Treaty," or as Senator Kerry put it, quote, that, Bush offered, here's the quote, "A policy change that serves neither our interests nor Taiwan's to remove the strategic ambiguity runs the risk of decreasing Taiwan's security rather than increasing it, and of eliminating the flexibility that we will need to determine how to respond in any given situation." One could offer a pretty good faith argument that their objections from the floor spoke to the text of the Taiwan Relations Act, which states that really Section 2 has these various policy statements. Section 3 has these statements with regard to implementation of policy. And Section 3 does have a fairly specific statement that in the event that Taiwan or its way of life is under threat, the president will notify and consult with Congress about the appropriate response. The way that played out specifically was a combination of this utterance by the president, conflicting statements coming from the White House and the State Department as they battled over how much or whether or not to walk it back and what specifically he meant. He clarified himself that afternoon. The way that process played out didn't give any ammunition necessarily to those on Capitol Hill, who, if it were in a clearly intentional and planned statement done in consultation with Congress, it probably a fair number of members who would have shown up. This is just 1 year after the debate over the Taiwan Security Enhancement Act. This is 2 days after the agreement on the arms sales package. There's a lot of wind in the sails of the U.S.-Taiwan relationship at this time. And it would, for all that lengthy statement, would come down to it was a kerfuffle and how it was created and handled, and that's how it played out. That stated, kind of very broadly, and in really agreeing with everything that Joe and Bridge have offered, and in particular, strategic ambiguity has been a specific approach to handle what is, in all security relationships, that balance between abandonment and entrapment that we always face, and fear and how to balance, and that's been the specific approach in this case. I believe that through declaratory policy would take time to socialize, and it would be in keeping with the TRA to socialize that between an administration and Congress in terms of specific policies that would help affect some of the changes the Bridge mentioned. That how do you get more high-level visits so that on coordination of policy can be seen as having greater credibility? How do you build additional bilateral military capabilities? How do you strengthen communications? And some of this goes all the way back to the Security Enhancement Act. That a lot of these are not particularly new ideas, but the Congress has never been opposed to those categorically, and if an administration has energy, there are lots of opportunities to do that. We can do a pretty long discussion on some of the back and forth in the 2000s and how the relationship had flowed when some of that wasn't done.
Great.
And
then I have some few questions now that I wanted to ask also the rest of the panels to also address. And so the first question is, obviously the 800-pound gorilla in the room is China. And, obviously this policy does not exist in a vacuum here. What do you think would be Beijing's reaction to a declaration of strategic clarity? What would it do, and why would it be in the U.S. interest to do so? Maybe perhaps just open that up for the past.
I think we could expect China to react vociferously and vigorously and cut off military relations for a while and do something else that expresses displeasure. We've seen this scenario before. But I don't think they would take any concrete action. We have to keep in mind that in 2005, because of its concern with the Chen administration and sentiment in the U.S. that was dangerously close to supporting, you know, some kind of independence move or a greater latitude from Taiwan. China passed the anti-secession law. And although Rick is right that the U.S. takes a position that Taiwan should do nothing specific or provocative, Taiwan, the anti-secession law allows grants to China the right to use force, even if Taiwan does nothing. If it simply continues the path it's on, de facto independence, and China wants concrete moves toward integration, toward political subordination. So we have that always in the background. Xi Jinping recently said this Taiwan issue is not going to be passed on from generation to generation. So lurking in the background, China has what it perceives as a legal basis to attack Taiwan if it gets fed up with Tsai Ing-wen or anyone else is not going to start moving to integration, for example, by adopting the 92 consensus and by talking to all China. So the clock is ticking. We have that going on. And from my perspective, it's less than until the U.S. says, let's get the record straight. Any move on Taiwan will bring a U.S. military response. Until that happens, the clock will be ticking. China will be building up its military capabilities to effectuate some kind of a move on Taiwan. And the situation is completely dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, well, I neglected to say this earlier, but let me join Chris and thank you, Russell, and congratulations on GTI. You guys are already a big force on this really increasingly important understudied issue in the last kind of decade or so. So it's great to be on the panel. Also, two great scholars and experts on these issues, and Chris and Joe. You know, I think Chris's points are right on, which is that this has to be done with, I think, if I characterize it correctly, kind of delicacy and sophistication, and in the sense that the objective here is not a specific kind of declaration or formal thing. The point is that we should make clearer to China that we will defend Taiwan if it's unjustifiably attacked. That means somehow communicating that to China, but in order to make a commitment credible, we kind of have to put our reputation on the line. So there's a degree of publicity about that. And for instance, getting Congress more involved always means there's more skin in the game, it's been socialized, people understand the implications. I mean, part of the problem right now is like, you hear from different people, oh, I know the U.S. would defend Taiwan. Oh, I know the U.S. wouldn't defend Taiwan. Well, the only person right now who knows, really, is probably the president. Now, except, like in the Korea context in 1950, circumstances are going to arise which are going to force probably a decision that you may not exactly anticipate. I mean, Barack Obama may have an idea of what he could do, but that may change based on circumstance. So I think the point is whatever, I mean, because I think the Chinese are going to be very unhappy about this, the mainland Chinese. So to the extent that we can minimize the what will be in a stick in the eye, that's great. You know, because there's no point in adding fuel to the fire of what will be a provocative act. But it seems to me that the provocation is strategically worthwhile because, the very act of accepting those costs is going to show to Beijing that we're serious. Whereas even if we just send our, you know, Assistant Secretary Gregson's successor over to China and say, hey, no, we're serious about this, how credible is that if we haven't put our reputation on the line? If we haven't said it in front of the Japanese and South Koreans and the Philippines and Australians and the Vietnamese and the Indians and so forth. So I think we have to weigh the competing interests, but you know, to the extent that we can thread the needle between being more public, but also shaving off some of the edges that are going to make the Chinese even more unhappy than they will already be, I think that's what we want to try to do.
It could be a subtle way of accomplishing exactly what Bridges is talking about. In the context of a foreign policy speech or State of the Union or Trump's inaugural, you can lay out a range of vital U.S. concerns and just happen to drop the name Taiwan. Mm-hmm. And once that's done, there's got to be a public commitment. That's the way.
I think you're right, yeah.
I think General Gregson had a comment that he wanted to make since he was called out by Bridge over there. I'm not sorry.
I didn't mean to.
Bridge was probably in the conversation.
Yeah. You're like Japan. You're coming in anyway. You know?
Wonderful. Yeah, I'm going to try one.
Okay.
Wonderful discussion. And on this last point about making clear in some believable way to China that we would indeed defend Taiwan, I would offer that for quite some time now, we have not objected to much. China builds 7 massive features in the South China Sea, and we say we're going to fly, sail, and operate wherever international law allows. Well, great, but that doesn't do anything for Vietnamese or Philippine fishermen. We sent 3 successive secretaries of defense to visit Beijing, different secretaries of defense, in 3 years. And 3 times, China rolls out a new stealth aircraft. And when we query, well, what about this? Well, we raised the issue in private. Well, it's an authoritarian government. Raising an issue in private doesn't do anything. Worse, and Vice President Biden was brought into this discussion earlier, and Senator Biden. Vice President Biden is on his way for an announcer, he's preparing for, just about to leave, on an announced trip to Beijing, and Beijing rolls out the East China Sea ATIS without coordination with anybody. And we still go. And we don't say anything in public about this. And there are others. Most recently, President Obama goes to Beijing, and despite all the 747s and 777s that land at the Beijing airport, we can't find a ramp to get him off the airplane. And we accept this.
And they don't apologize.
Well, not only that, we didn't say anything. We said, well, this is not a big deal. Yeah, it's a big deal. As somebody who used to have to worry about protocol for PRC visitors, the substance of the conversation here in Washington didn't mean a thing. What they were after was the symbols of all the protocol to broadcast back home about what a big guy they are. And yet they do this to our president. We talk a lot about transparency and having a relationship with China. We are becoming the abused spouse in this relationship. And we are not transparent because we aren't candid. And I would submit that a change of administration, and it doesn't have to, and this is a bipartisan bill. It's not one party. So when I say change of administration, I don't mean that I'm taking sides here. But with the change of administration, it's a great chance to abuse an already abused phrase, hit the reset button, and start being candid in public, and making sure that we understand and that they understand that we do have some limits, and some way to also appeal to our other allies over there. This has got to be accompanied with getting back to the city on the hill thing again and starting to talk from the U.S. point of view, the bully pulpit, about things we believe in. Last point on this rant. In 2008, the president specifically told the Chinese delegation for the Strategic and Economic Dialogue at the Reagan Center that we're going to continue to talk about human rights because that's who we are. Right. Within months, actually weeks, we decided we're not going to do that because we have more important issues with China. I think that was a massive own goal. Strategic rights is our brand around the world. We're not talking about human rights. We're not talking about human rights. We're not talking to the Chinese population or the population of Russia or the aggrieved people in Aleppo or the people in Syria and all these things. We're playing that government and giving up the ideals that America stands for, and we got to get back to that along with being candid about what we stand for.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, sorry, because Chris, I'm sure you'll, but I mean, it may be a little more interesting. I agree with that too. I spent the last decade thinking we were talking too much about human rights and democracy, but I think, General Gregson, you're right, both from a kind of moral point of view, but also from a strategic point of view, which is that this is a source of, you know, of leverage for us. You know, and we shouldn't be giving the Chinese Communist Party a free pass on, you know, all the kinds of depredations that they're doing. And I think, you know, because China's so powerful, we're going to be limited in how much we can do about it. And then, you know, we're not going to go to thermonuclear war over it. But I think we need to be, you know, stick to our guns and you know, say what we believe
And to be clear, I'm not talking about picking a fight.
No, I know. I think you expressed what I agree with, but which is that, like, hey, we're America. Like, you know, we're going to work with people that we don't always agree with, but we're going to say what we think, and you know what we stand for, and that's, you know, you don't get a pass on it.
Before we open up to questions, I do have a couple of questions I do want to get through before opening up for Q&A. And this is also quite related to Bridge, the comments that you were making initially in your first two questions that I had. And that is, stopping short of basically having a mutual defense treaty with Taiwan, in which case, according to Victor Chaz, who was the former director of Asian Affairs at the National Security Council, new book called Power Play, in which he observed that the treaty was as much about defending Taiwan as it was for restraining Chiang Kai-shek. What would Taiwan's interest be in this sort of newfound sort of clarity in U.S. Support for Taiwan?
Yes, Commander.
Yeah, I'm asking you.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, I think, his original article, which is a superb piece by Victor Chai, is called Restraining Alliances, and it was Chiang Kai-shek. In fact, what Truman said, I believe, when he announced the deployment of Joe, correct me if I'm wrong, when he announced the deployment of the 7th Fleet, was that they were separating the parties. It was not intervention clearly on behalf of the Kuomintang. Now, obviously, in fact, it was. But and I think what Eisenhower was thinking about with the Mutual Defense Treaty was having more leverage over Chiang Kai-shek over the offshore islands and stuff that we've seen about. Same thing with President Lee and Lee in South Korea, and of course with Japan. So these countries are all, you know, have developed a lot politically, and so it's a fundamentally different thing. But this is also true in Europe, right? The old adage about Europe was about NATO was the point is to keep the Americans in, the Soviets out, and the Germans down. So there's also a restraining element in our European alliances. I think with Taiwan, I mean, Taiwan has limited leverage in the situation, right? So assuming that Taiwan wants to maintain the status quo or something like it, my sense is Taiwan should make America's life, make America's decision to intervene on its behalf if pressed or if attacked as easy as possible. And so, you know, that means having as politically strong a position as possible, which means, you know, taking a kind of reasonable position. And I think most people respect that Taiwan has the Taiwan status quo. And from a military perspective, developing a military posture that is going to delay the Chinese, is going to make it much harder for them, is going to make any attack on the island much more brazen and aggressive looking. So that it's not a glass jaw. These will make American intervention easier and more likely. I also think Taiwan, you know, I think this is true. Taiwan, the vigorous democracy that's on Taiwan and the freedoms and so forth are an example. And the American people, I think, if Taiwan were unjustifiably attacked, would really speak to the American people and to people in like-minded countries around the world. So I think those are the things that Taiwan is, but they're. You know, I think there's some things that could be done differently, but I think Taiwan has otherwise China's going to be so powerful that it could pull off, you know, if we don't take a strong stand, well, you know, you risk what's happening in the South China Sea happening in Taiwan too. So.
Just a historical point, referencing that point, it was not an academic question at the time. As soon as the Korean War broke out, Chiang Kai-shek approached Washington and asked for permission to attack the mainland, return to the mainland.
Right.
Supported this country for it. The phrase used to be unleash Chang. So Eisenhower was not imagining a threat from both sides of the Taiwan Strait.
No, just not on the specific point of the piece, but just in the context of consistency. And this gets back to a point that Joe raised earlier about Jonai's comment about we don't know and we don't know either. But at the same time, I think for Congress, Kirk Campbell said that our policy was strategic clarity and tactical ambiguity. Bill Perry, meeting with his Chinese counterpart, warned of grave consequences. 2 out of 3, not always bad. In the context of strategic signaling, probably not the school.
You know, Perry also quoted Joe Nye. He was asked the question a month later and meet the president and said, oh, I think I'll abide by what Joe Nye said. That's probably
okay, last question.
would a declaration of strategic clarity require an amendment to the Taiwan Relations Act? More generally, what effects would it have on the TRA? This is for the entire
I'll hop in first on that. Amending the TRA would be probably the clearest step possible to demonstrate coordination between the administration and the legislative branch. The idea that through the TRA, Congress has had such a unique role in this relationship would reaffirm that. That have a cheerful book here. If you don't have it, highly recommended the Legislative History of the Taiwan Relations Act or multiple volumes. You see the conference report language, floor statements. It's actually unique and invaluable that the efforts have gone to compile these over time. That is by far the most effective way if there is an agreed, articulated policy. Is it necessary to make these changes? No. Would it be useful to ensure that future administrations know what the left-right limits are in this relationship? Yes. So that's the balance that you're looking at. But the fact that the TRA has not been amended should not be an obstacle to considering these changes.
Okay, well then I'd like to open up to questions. So please wait for the mic, state your name and your affiliation, and please direct your question to either the entire panel or just one specifically. And Nadia?
Thank you, Russell, and the panel. My name is Nadia Chow, Washington correspondent for Liberty Times. I think General Grigson just mentioned one point that all the journalists are very interested about a reset after the new government, Donald Trump's. And he didn't really talk too much about his Asian strategy, except his trade policy, maybe some points on defense. So I wonder, would you like to comment when he come to the White House? What kind of Asian strategy we are looking at? You may just guess, but that's also welcome.
So we had one indication during the campaign when the pushing of North Korea came up. Trump said, North Korea is a problem created by China. China has to resolve it. I think there was a lot of truth in that. China has in fact enabled North Korea's I don't know how seriously Trump meant that comment, or whether he has a thought through the policy of the pressure with China. There are things we can do with China to have it step up its pressure on North Korea, whether Trump will pursue those or not, as that remains to be seen.
We'll briefly offer what I'll be looking to. It's important to be cognizant of the difference between campaigning and governing. And we saw this in 2000, 2001, where comments that candidate Bush made were not of notable interest to the media. Comments that President Bush made were taken very seriously. So what President Trump says will be much more significant than what candidate Trump has said. He has not said much that indicates that he has articulate plans yet on these issues. So in the intervening months, I'll be watching closely, I suspect we all will, to see what personnel he appoints to his cabinet, and as the administration begins to fill in, that what experience does the administration have working these issues will probably be the key issue to follow.
I would just add that, in terms of getting some sort of sense in terms of what, Trump's Asia policy may be, I'd point people to the article that was just published 2 days ago, the day before the election, by Alex Gray and Peter Navarro in the Foreign Policy website, and where he outlines, what Trump's Asia policy will be. Tom?
My name is Tom Hughes. Among other things, I'm a member of the Advisory Council here. Feel free to take this as a totally rhetorical question. But in terms of the U.S. making a specific public commitment to defend Taiwan in the military circumstances that have been described here, is there sufficient, one, support in Congress for such an action? Two, support in the general public for such an action? And three, apropos of the question about the new president, Is there support there as well? My own particular view, hence the idea of a rhetorical question, is that certainly in Congress and in the public, I do not believe there is the remotest foundation for support for such a declaration.
For anyone who does not know, Tom Hughes, he's also the former chief of staff to Senator Clinton.
I think if you were to take a referendum or a survey or a poll of the American public today, Tom, I think you would be correct in your assessment. But that's what leadership is about. I think the president needs to explain to the American public what's at stake in Asia and Southeast Asia, and Taiwan's status both in terms of humanitarian values and its strategic location. Quote MacArthur, unsinkable aircraft carrier. So, yeah, I think it's an uphill climb, but it requires public education as to what's at stake. And it doesn't apply just to Taiwan, as General Gregson said. There are several issues there. There's North Korea, there's the South China Sea, and there's Taiwan, which are the three flashpoints. There are a little strategic clarity from the U.S. in all of those areas would be very useful.
Yeah, I mean, you would know better on the congressional side for sure. I mean, I think there... I was in a meeting with a prominent academic recently who was getting in an argument about defense issues, and he said, "I don't want to get into a nuclear war over the Baltics," which my response was, "Neither do I, but I also don't want to get into a nuclear war over the United Kingdom or Canada or, frankly, California." So, you know, I think the American people are also skeptical about, you know, if asked, would be skeptical. Very skeptical about defending the Philippines, potentially defending Japan. So a lot of this is part, I think, and we all know this, is part of a broader conversation about, frankly, about China and about the power balance in the Pacific, not to be sort of disappearing, but I mean, are we going to work to balance China or not? And if we are, you know, which is, then I think Taiwan is absolutely part of the conversation. And if we're not, then we are, you know, then Taiwan's not the only thing that's on the table. Now, Taiwan, obviously, because of its special circumstances, is a tougher issue. My inclination would be to, working with the Congress would be to try to firm up declaratory policy in a way that doesn't put it as a, I mean, in a sense, to me, what we should basically be doing is saying what we are likely to end up doing anyway, which is that if Taiwan is brazenly attacked by the People's Republic, I think there will be a very, very strong pressure for us to respond militarily. And then if that's the case, I mean, it's the same thing that the British faced in 1914. I mean, if that's the case, then don't leave any doubt in the Germans' mind of what's going to happen, because then they can explain themselves, you know, then in the arguments in Beijing, they'll say, well, no, these Americans are just bluffing. This strategic ambiguity thing is a shield for them to back down in the midst of a crisis. If we're going to respond probably anyway, then let's at least make sure they're aware of it. So I think that's my argument. I'm sympathetic to Taiwan. I think, you know, it's incredibly impressive what's happened on Taiwan, but this is fundamentally a strategic argument to me about deterring war.
Public opinion, of course, will change as events change. There's a kind of brazen attack that we're just talking about. The American public will respond.
Hello, I'm Ben, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. So my question is about the six-year assurances. Do you see the need to escalate the status of six-year assurances? Because as far as I know, it's not a legal document. It's more of a tacit understanding of how U.S. presidents deal with Taiwan. Would you recommend to, let's say, the President-elect Trump that six assurances should be part of a law as opposed to what we have now? Thank you.
Legislative implications. But I mean, just one point. Six assurances, of course, were made after the 1982 communique between Reagan and China, which pledged to gradually downgrade our defense commitment to Taiwan as the threat receded. I think that was a mistaken communique. I think Reagan was wrong to assign that. And that's where the six assurances came in after. We said, well, we didn't really mean everything you were reading into that. Explain what the U.S. policy actually is.
I would agree. You know, under current policy, under current law, under TRA, there is a lot of space to modify our current activities, any kind of declaratory policy from the White House. One thing that this does bring in mind, and I can only repeat what my fellow panelists have said, but most articulately on the questions of public support, if this were attempted. I think one example, and this touches on an earlier question also from Russell, that in terms of how would China respond to the challenges that we find ourselves in. I think the Senkaku Diaoyutai situation is probably an interesting model where the Chinese government has sought to get, so fine, you say you recognize Japanese administration, or in light of Japanese administration, if also in the treaty, we'll try to undermine Japanese administration, then to see, you know, what are the areas we, you know, unjustified aggression, however we define or think of aggression, what steps could they take to attack the definitional terms? So the language here would become very important if it were adopted by the administration.
But that's still a great point. It's a little bit like the hybrid situation in Europe, but I mean, to me, that would be something to basically, if the Chinese said, okay, now we have, in light of the changing military balance, we're still confident the Americans would come in, then we have to mess around with the unjustified aggression thing. That narrows the problem considerably, I think, in a meaningful and material way.
We have time for one last question. Okay.
Tony Liao, Central News Agency, Taiwan. The question regarding about arms sales to Taiwan, should new president reconsider submarine and fighter jet sale to Taiwan, which current government refused to do it for more than a decade? Thank you.
Yes.
I guess so. I would just say, and I'd have to look at this with more care, but I think that the military sales packages should be designed to serve the objectives that I'm talking about, not the shiny objects and service priorities. And I mean, it's hard for me to see F-16s taking off and surviving, given that Chinese SAMs are going to cover the island. I think that's, you know, there's no way Taiwan can meaningfully contest Chinese air dominance. The Americans can, although even that will be very, very difficult. So I would rather see Taiwan spend more on resilient command and control, anti-air, anti-ship, frankly, anti-ground personnel kind of things. Basically, a little bit like what the Baltics are doing, although with more capability, which is just make Taiwan as nasty a hedgehog as you possibly can, and don't spend money on anything else. I mean, maybe kind of UUV, you know, kind of modern, relatively expendable and inexpensive unmanned. I'd rather have a lot of smart mines, like just flood the Taiwan Strait with smart mines to make an amphibious invasion as difficult and a blockade as difficult as possible. Submarines are not going to survive against. In any way, if submarines are going to, people are going to be doing the submarining are the Americans. So
no one's not going to make a meaningful contribution. I just finally add that President Obama still has the time to do the right thing, so it's still not over yet.
Yeah, right.
So with that, please join me in thanking the panelists for a wonderful conversation. And stay tuned for the announcement for our next event, which will be on Taiwan as the next Asia Silicon Valley. And we'll be sending out announcements about that shortly.
Russell, it was excellent.
Thank you, Tom.
You're a good moderator.
Thank you.